speaking about the training manuals, and I believe at about the same time we were undergoing a GAO audit of the functions of the division, primarily disclosure operations, and we had already had staff meetings about the need for manuals, which really spelled out our procedures and what the staff should be doing under certain circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. And I think in general everybody thought they were probably a good idea for training purposes. One factor that entered my mind at the time was that it would probably ring well also with the oversight committees, with the GAO folks, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it did. I think that was one of the end results of those manuals, that because I think I have seen some correspondence from some law firms on the outside who thought that certain of the procedures that we adopted, industry centralization, selective review, I think the term that I recall reading as a quote was that they were brilliant.
Yeah, they originally were intended just for the staff, but as I understand it, under the FOIA, they became public ultimately, and they did get a very good review.
Yeah, they got most of the. I can never remember whether it was procedures or practices. One was more internal, and there were things expurgated out of them, but. It was one of John Huber's big battles, was his attempt to keep them from being public, and which he lost in the end, and they did become that along with, and of course that also led in our area to the no action letters, and not the no action, but the telephone responses and those kinds of things being made public too, which I think in the long term actually help the staff, because they help people better understand on the outside what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I think once you get past the sort of, well, we shouldn't be telling everybody our secrets idea, you get to the point where it's actually better that people know what's going on. And I think it was a good thing.
I do remember under this selective review system is when Linda Quinn was the director, and I guess Ernestine had recommended this, that there be a certain entities that would file proxy statements that we also wouldn't review their proxy statements. And I remember I felt that we should review all of the proxy statements and shouldn't, because that was, in my mind, was a very important document for revealing information about stewardship of a company. And I remember we were at a meeting, I don't know if you were there, mentioned we were, our voices were rising, et cetera, et cetera, and I wasn't going to back off, and Linda was the boss, and I lost. But I remember we were going round and round about that, and I felt that the, particularly with respect to insider transactions, I felt was always, that the proxy document was very important, that's where you could get your hooks into them as regulators, et cetera, et cetera. And I was concerned that the big entities weren't going to be reviewed, et cetera, and that the staff might miss things, et cetera. But I lost, and I guess the world hasn't quit spinning since we've done
that. Well, it turns out that on insider transactions, a lot of companies weren't disclosed.
In the end.
Whether it would have been caught by review or not, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's
absolutely, it would have been.
Well, you mentioned how you got stuck with the budget when you became associate director. Was the budget one of your responsibilities throughout your tenure, or was that just
it was
throughout?
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell us about your experience briefly with the budget in terms of when you first started. I guess it was during the Carter administration, and then later on with the Republican.
Well, up through my time as an AD, I was only generally aware that that there was need for promotions and slots when we felt we didn't have enough people, we wanted to hire people, etc. I had no real idea of the formulas for staff years and efficiency factors, etc., etc. So when I became an associate, the division's part of the budget had been handled by Neil McCoy, who really was the the senior attorney, I guess,
He was the associate director of legal.
He had been handling the budget for quite a while, et cetera. So when I came up, he was delighted to transfer that responsibility to me. And then I became aware of how the budget was put together. You would do a draft of the workload of the division, which would include obviously registration statements, proxies, no action letters, referrals to enforcement, etc. And you would relate this to a piece of paper and staff years, which is a very significant element in the budget process. And then we would send it to, in those days, it would go up to the executive director's office and the controller's office, and then they would send back some thoughts. But the budget process in 1977, I guess is about when I got involved, wasn't anywhere near as complicated as it is today or at the time that I retired, primarily because of the onset of zero-based budgeting. And I had no idea. I went to a training session, and this was under the Carter administration, because as I remember, when Mr. Carter was governor of the state of Georgia, he augmented ZBB, and they felt that it was wonderful down there, that it you start out with what your mission was at the zero level, and then at various increments of staff years, you would demonstrate your effectiveness or efficiency with the input of additional staff years. And also you had to support and substantiate your existence, etc. And in my opinion, a then small regulatory agency like the SEC to be spending this much manpower preparing a budget of that nature, to me, didn't seem to be effective and efficient. And I complained a little bit. I lost that argument as well because we went into ZBB with a passion. And it began to grow and grow and grow with each change in the stewardship up in the executive director's office, maybe the controller's office, I don't know. But we had to increment these various levels of efficiency, and then we had to add a final line, and that is in the budget request. If we requested, let's say, 50 additional staff years, what could we accomplish with the 50 additional staff years? And we had to have that at low points and medium points and high points, and the budgets became a mass of paper. And so, yeah, I used to pull my hair out over that. And then with the input, the workload system about 1977 was all done on manual records. And so everything done on the budget at that time was based on these manual records. Well, with the augment of the computer system, this was before Edgar. We tried to implement, and it was Greek to me, and again, I think it came out of Ernestine's office, that you could tie your computers into the branches in what became known as a local area network. And every branch, when they received workload assignments, would download at a computer at the branch level the filings that they had, and then as they issued their letters of comment or whatever, they would update that system. And then that local area network, at the magic moment, we could be able to generate a computer report which showed that information. Yeah. Well, at the time, I thought, well, this is crazy, et cetera, et cetera. But the more we worked on it, the better it got. Now, in my last 3 or 4 years, we used those workload runs, and they became quite massive as the basis for workload reports in the division's budget processes. And I don't know if they still use them or not. I know many staff members.
Well, as of 4 years ago, they still did.
Really?
And they still distribute. And of course, as someone on the other end, those reports were also then generated every week, and then they became sort of your, you had to keep looking at those to see how you were doing, because if you were falling behind the curve, you were in big trouble.
That's
so,
right.
So they became sort of the thing that ran the agent, or at least
the division.
But again, I think those systems, if you have the proper hardware and software, as well as the operators, because the staff had to learn computerese in order to utilize the machines. And it probably was a very good budget and workload control system. But the budget function, I always felt that we needed a full-time person in the division to do budget. I mean, I only did it at night, at the end of the day there. And now I understand that Herb Scholl is the main budget.
Yeah, I think that's
right. Well, he has been for several years. Yeah. Even when you were, I guess, Bill Carter was doing it for a long time for you, because he was, after Jack Wheeler, Bill Carter was your assistant, and
that's
Bill
right.
was, in the early years you were doing it, Bill was doing it with you, and then...
And Bill hated the...
Well, he hated it, and then he got back to the chief counsel's office, and then I think Herb was the one who stepped in, and that, of course, now Herb has a complete office of his own, as in addition to his budget stuff, and all that came with the advent of the computerization of the
Well, I'll tell you, in the history of things, when we were at First Street and we were doing budgets and we were doing work, and Ernestine's office was up and running, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we had adopted selective review and industry centralization, and we were well on our way to the shelf rule and so forth. But the time in registration still was longer than the 20-day period that the statute refers to. And the staff at First Street was an unhappy bunch, I will tell you that. And about that time, I think it was the chairman had augmented a system where periodically representatives from outside law firms would drop in and we'd have a tete-a-tete about things. And those meetings, well, I had a couple in my office at First Street. I had this huge office over there, but the building was horrible. The carpets were mildewed. The water system was...
But the windows
was
open.
Putrid. And the windows were open. So on this one day, there was a meeting with the folks from these law firms, and it was over in the hearing room of the commission. And I went over, and these folks, you know, wanted to talk about time in registration. And I was in a bad mood. I forgot what had happened, et cetera, and over there. And we sat down, and we small-talked a little bit, and they wanted to know. Well, we were really hurting staff-wise. We had been cut. We couldn't fill vacancies. There may have been a freeze happening, et cetera. And I kind of lost it a little bit, and I said, if we didn't get some additional staff years, I thought that this term that represented the time in registration before the first letter would go off the Richter scale, would be maybe at that time it might have been, I don't know, 65 days or something was the average. And I said it would probably go up to 6 months or 7 months. Or so. And I could see these folks just sitting there looking at me like, well, and it's a true story, I swear to God, because that afternoon they apparently had a meeting with the chairman, these same folks. And I got a phone call from Ed Green, and he said, what did you tell those guys? And I said, well, you know, I told him that we have all these vacancies in the branches, and the workload is on the rise, and I said, we just can't stay up with it, et cetera, et cetera. And they weren't authorizing overtime at that time either, I think. Well, apparently shortly thereafter, in the budget process that we were involved in, the chairman authorized a hefty increase in staff years for court film, et cetera. So I always thought, well, it might have gone either way. He could have fired me on the spot for being outspoken.
That little bar chart showing the number of days till first comments was the thing that ruled our lives.
Well, that we
yeah. For
well, who was the chairman? What was his name? Remember the chairman that started all this? Started all this. We used to get statistics for him every month. Chairman Breed.
Chairman Breed. When Linda was the director, the statistics.
We got that man every week. It was a book.
Yes,
and it had bar charts and line graphs and everything, and it had all kinds of information. First out of common, times of effectiveness, different kinds of filings.
When he was so interested in international, there were pages about how many international filings there were.
It was a huge thing. Weekly statistical information overload.
The main thing was that the only thing that really meant anything was the first page where it showed how many days, if you'd gone up a half a day in your average review time, then you had a problem. You know, that was, I don't know whether that still exists.
Did it exist after Breeden left?
It ended after Linda left.
They take a life of their own, somebody gets it, and then it just keeps on going.
It started as Linda was leaving, and then that no longer became the case. But
they probably pulled that data off that local area.
Oh, yeah, they did. It was everything that got fed into the computers.
Herb
generated all those
statistics.
We had statistics.
All these pretty colors and everything. It was a beautiful little book.
Bill, let's talk, if we can, a little bit about integrated disclosure, because that occurred during your period as an associate director. Mm-hmm. Whose idea was that? Get implemented and so forth?
Well, my vague recollection of that is that the idea started before I became an associate.
The Wheat Report was where it started. And that was with Dick Rowe, and that was the first thing, and it moved dramatically later on, but that was the first suggestion.
Yeah. I remember when Wheat was commissioner, his principal legal assistant was Dick Rowe.
Dick Rowe did a lot of work on
the so-called Wheat Report, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I remember at one of the old commission meetings, and it had to do with when a company was going to be late filing its 10-K, they would file a application for extension of time. I was a branch chief, and Hawker was an AD, and Mr. Wheat was commissioner, and Dick Rowe was the legal assistant. And there was a company that we had granted an extension of time to file the 10-K, and then they filed a second one. I don't recall if the staff granted that or not, but if not, we were considering it. But in the meantime, the company blew up, and it was in the paper, et cetera, and we had to go up to the commission and explain why we had granted the extension of time. And I didn't know Mr. Wheat at the time. I mean, I knew who he was, but I hadn't had any experience with him. It was my branch that had granted the damn thing, and it was a routine application. Whether the company was fibbing or they weren't represented appropriately or what, I don't know, but the staff got it as a matter of routine and granted it. Well, Mr. Wheat was real mad. he was chewing Ralph Hawker and me out. We were at the commission table, and for some reason, the more he talked, the madder he got. Remember Ralph?
That was Williams. You don't mean Wheat himself, do you?
Yeah.
Wheat. Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're right.
He was the chairman, but he was commissioner.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, well, whoever the chairman was at that time, he just sat there. Mr. Wheat was just a commissioner. And I remember him telling, he got so mad about it. He was really furious, et cetera. And we were there, you know, mea culpa, you know, hindsight, we made a mistake, and what are you going to do, et cetera. And he was so infuriated. I remember he basically threw us out of the meeting. He said, you better get out of here while the getting is good, et cetera, et cetera. And Ralph Hawker was so mad when we were going back to the office, he couldn't even speak to be treated like that, you know, et cetera. And I remember we got a phone call from Dick Rowe that he was trying to kind of apologize, you know, for the thing, et cetera. But I never will forget that. That was a bad time. But now the integrated disclosure, as I vaguely recall, it sort of started because there were some bright people on the outside who were kind of talking also about hey, we filed a registration statement. We disclosed all this information in the S-1, let's say. And then later on, we filed the 10-Ks and the proxy. We have to repeat the same information, et cetera. And then if we want to market securities, we have to prepare this big document all over again. I remember seeing a memo on that before I became associate.
I think the Advisory Committee on Corporate Disclosure recommended that, too. And I think, and Dick Rowe followed up on that. That was like the beginning of what's now Regulation S-K. And that was the Advisory Committee of Corporate Disclosure recommended it, and Dick Rowe kind of implemented it and with his Regulation S-K, and that sort of got the ball rolling more and more.
An awful lot of intelligent manpower was spent on that, because as things began to move in the division, primarily in the rulemaking area, you know, the staff was struggling with it. And then, you know, they promulgated the different S forms, the S9 was one, I remember, et cetera, et cetera. But in the meantime, we were still having to fight, if you will, these audits and these internal strife matters, and the manpower that we had to waste on that, had we not had to deal with, you know, maybe that's life, et cetera, but we had to deal with that. Had we not had to spend those hours there, we could have spent it on these other matters and really been able to make faster progress on these various things. And anyway, that's my general understanding of the integrated disclosure system. It made sense. It was a smart idea, wherever it initiated from. And it was long overdue.
Yeah. Well, Bill, we've taken over 2 hours of your time. Is there anything else that you think merits discussion?
No, not that I recall from my historical perception. I kind of liked the idea when you called me up and said we were going to meet. I got out some of my old papers and refreshed my memory. Most of which are good about it, and I appreciate the opportunity myself to refresh my memory on these things. I had a great time there. I still miss a lot of it. As I said at my retirement function, I don't miss the nonsensical aspects of the job. I don't miss the rush hour headaches, which my sons tell me now is even 5 times worse than when I retired.
I can attest to that.
I don't miss that, but I certainly love my time at the commission, and I hope I've assisted your project.
Well, this has been terrific. Yep. I tell you, if others are as forthcoming as you in terms of talking about their experience at the commission, I think it's going to be a great record here for the Historical Society. So thank you again, Bill, and we all
appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Bye.
Thank you. Okay.
Beginning again.
All right, so it's tape 2 then.
Yeah, tape 2. What I was saying was, I think that a lot of it had to do with the civil service requirements, because it was somewhat, because the lawyers were the accepted service, you could hire them without having to go through civil service roles. If you were a financial analyst or an accountant, you had to be hired off the civil service role, so you couldn't just go out and get people to come in, because they might get bumped by somebody who had veterans preference or something, because they had to go through the so the hiring was much more difficult for non-attorneys. So because it was easier, because the staffing levels changed so quickly, it was much more easy to react to hire attorneys than it was financial analysts. That I think that's one of the reasons that the mix started to change so dramatically, because it certainly did.
Yeah.
I mean, there are no financial analysts in branches anymore, I don't believe.
Only the real old
ones. And there are a few, but most of them have actually been transferred to other offices. They work for Herb Scholl or in some kind. So almost exclusively, there are attorneys and accountants in the branches. And then, of course, the accountant change was something a much later change.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'll be frank. I always thought that you'd have a better division if you had longevity. I always stuck. Now, there are some exceptions, and I certainly remember some of the problems, even if some of the branch chiefs through my time were no longer branch chiefs after I found out what they were doing. There were some imperfect individuals in those jobs, but I always thought that when you have rapid turnover, particularly, now I didn't know that you don't have any more analysts by background who are branch chiefs. I think that's important.
I would say
there may be a couple, but they're not many.
Carryovers, yeah. Hmm. Just because there's no analyst coming up. I mean, because they're not hiring any new analysts, there's no analyst coming up. Hmm. I think Shelley was an analyst.
Well, Shelley Parrott was a financial analyst, right?
But she was a financial analyst, and Daly.
Jim Daly, they're both associate.
And so there are some, but very, very few. And as time goes on, there'll be none because they're just not hiring financial analysts anymore.
If you don't have anybody to get experience and to move up the line, then there's no way you can have financial, and they just don't.
Interesting. Well, I know that the non-attorneys had to be hired off the competitive service arrangements. And back in the before 65. Yeah, the branch chiefs and the ADs, they tended to stay right there. In a sense, I never looked upon that as anything bad. You really grew, inbred knowledge of the work, the division, the commission, et cetera, et cetera. I was a great advocate for promoting from within. We'll get into that later on, I guess, but I always thought that I knew it happened. Under the Nixon administration, where you have the plumb book after elections, in my
Careful
time...
now, that's how I got hired.
Well, in my time, the only job in a regulatory agency was the executive director, the Scheidenhelm job. But that went out of the window under the Nixon administration. They began salting agencies and departments at the senior level, and then it got all the way down to the grade 14 level. And in my experience, my experience is only with the SEC, Marine Corps and the SEC. I have some friends that work in some other agencies, and they were experiencing the same thing. But I think it undercut morale. It caused some problems, and it's certainly didn't help the maintaining of good efficiency to getting the job done, i.e. protecting investors and so forth. That's what I thought and still do.
Speaking of people being brought in from the outside, what is your recollection, and not to single him out, but only because he became famous, of Faye Vincent, who came in, I guess, in the late 70s as an associate director and only stayed for a few months, I think.
About a year.
Yeah.
He got a job in the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
It was Coca-Cola in the beginning.
Yeah,
but,
right.
Those were not good times. That was in my opinion, he was a lightweight in regards to securities knowledge. He was brought in under the Williams administration. We didn't know it at the time, we being Roe and I. I know you were up there, but I don't know where the hell you were in those days. But
I was an associate director when Faye came on board, yeah.
So was I.
Yeah, you and me and Neil had left, hadn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yes,
well, you probably took Neil's position,
I imagine.
Yeah, briefly.
Did.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but since we're on that, what the hell. Williams came in, and he appointed maybe Ralph was I think Ralph may have already been up there. Ralph Farrar was up there as the legal assistant and
to the chairman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Williams appointed Ben Milk as executive director.
Yes, I remember Ben.
And Amy Goodman was up there. Harold came in, introduced himself. We had meetings. We had meetings in Roe's office. Harold was there with Ralph Ferrara, and Harold was going around meeting the heads of all of the major divisions and introducing himself. And I certainly was naive. I thought, well, gee, this is a great thing. The guy's wonderful. It's stuff that wants to know, you know, what we do, how we do it, et cetera, et cetera. And left. And we thought things were in super shape. And if you remember, these were the days after the Rod Hills regime. And the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and all the horrible screaming and yelling we used to do every day at the commission table and so forth and so on. And Neil McCoy left. I really don't know anything about that. I think he was going to leave anyway. He had a better job, et cetera, et cetera. We proposed, after talking to lots of people, we proposed Jack Hennigan as the associate. And we sent a memo up. And we waited, and we waited, and we waited, and we waited. And God damn it, it just went on and on and on and on. And there were tasks that Neil McCoy's office did that were highly important. He stuck me with the budget as he left, and all the personnel stuff, et cetera, et cetera. In addition to disclosure operations, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, Neil left, and it finally dawned on Dick Rowe. He called me one day, and he said, you know, there's something wrong. He said, they're not going to approve this thing. So, you know, we didn't know what to do. I know we talked to you about it, et cetera. And then we renominated Roland Cook. Remember Roland Cook?
Sure, yeah, of course, yeah.
Well, we set that name up, and we waited, 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 and finally, and in the meantime, these wacko memos began showing up from Harold. CC'd with Ralph Ferrara and Amy Goodman. And Harold, it finally dawned on me. I mean, I'm not stupid, but I was a little slow on the update. He came in with a preconceived notion that enforcement and Court Finn were not doing the right thing. His big baby was corporate governance, of course, but he didn't understand how we declared registration statements effective. He didn't understand the carve-outs, the Tandy letter thing, how we declared post-effective amendments effective. I don't think he liked delegated authority in that sense. And he would send down these memos, and I would do drafting, and Roe would polish them up, and we'd send them up, and we'd wait and wait and wait, and the memos would come back. And he'd say things that, like, well, I'm sorry I'm responding to your memo so late, but I've read your memo, and I found them a little too lengthy and not all that enlightening. He put that in. And I'm not just talking, I have one in my file. And I remember Roe, the first time he got it, he didn't understand. The second time he got one, he was really mad. And not long after that, Roe got a call and went up and came back, and we got Faye Vincent.
Well, Harold Williams had every intention of appointing the new director. That's what he was after.
Yeah.
And his intent was, the person he was going to hire as associate director was going to be the new director. And that's why he wasn't picking any of these other people. Oh. And he picked Ray Vincent, and he named him associate director. Well, first of all the associate directors, and there were about three of us before, with or without, I guess it was you, Dick, no, Dick was director by then, you, me, and Ray Vincent, I guess. And we all treated him like an equal, associate director. And that wasn't what he had in mind. So when Ray Vincent left, after a few short months, you remember that the next person that was appointed by Williams was Ed Green.
That's
and
the
he
director.
Didn't make
deputy.
A mistake of making
oh,
him an
deputy.
Associate director.
Yeah.
He made
yeah.
him a deputy director so that he made it loud and clear that this was who he wanted for a director as soon as possible. I mean, I think it was, must have been very awkward times for Richard.
Let me tell you, he brought in Vincent as a headhunter because while Vincent was there, and that's right. We tried to work with him. We tried to be fully cooperative and et cetera. But not long after he was, and I don't know the details. I know some things, but I don't want to get into that. But they retired Ruth Appleton forcibly. And I remember her coming into my office in tears. She couldn't understand what the hell was going on. And that's when I got my first inkling about Vincent.
Now, Ruth was head of regional office operations.
She's a reggae.
Well, and she also had tender office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they were combined at that point, yeah.
And I remember being in Vincent's office one day when he was, I think he was talking to the chairman, and he had the balls to say in my presence that he wasn't getting full cooperation in the job. And he hung up, and I asked him what cooperation was he talking about, because we had, I mean, he asked me simple things like, you know, how do you, things about SH, there was something he had about the stock option plan or something. I went back and I wrote a memo and I sent it to him, and he wanted to know about delegated authority and declaring registrations effective. And I mentioned that Harold Williams was off on that too with these stupid memos and so forth. But anyway, I never saw any real evidence that Vincent was really a knowledgeable Securities Act lawyer. He may have been, but I didn't see it, etc. And we were so happy when he announced he was leaving and going out. And I thought it was Coca-Cola.
No, he went to Columbia Pictures. Yeah, he went.
I think he came from, well, he was at Coca-Cola. Yeah.
Columbia got taken over.
Yeah, that's right.
And,
yeah.
Then, and then he was there for a couple of years, and then he went on to be baseball commissioner.
Things that began to happen under the Williams administration, in my judgment, at least for Corp Fin, and I think equally for enforcement, morale plummeted. Nobody knew what the hell was going on. Everybody started backbiting. We really couldn't get the job done. It was awful. And I'll tell you something else. When I was promoted in 1976 to associate, I waited 3 years to get my grade raise.
Really?
Damn right.
Wow.
Now, I do know...
How'd they get away with that?
Well, that was before the SES, just before. And that job was a super grade.
It was a grade 16.
A grade 16. Okay. And in the civil service, there were only so many super grades. So if you applied and were picked, you would get the job, but you had to wait for civil service to free up.
It's the same way. The same thing with SES. You only have so many SES positions.
People sit in SES positions a year or two before they get.
Wow. Well, I remember probably Williams came. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
About 77
he came, and that's when Milk got upstairs. But before that, I remember. When Ralph Hocker was associate, he had a meeting. That's when Ralph Ferrara was a branch chief or something in enforcement. And there was a meeting in Ralph's office, and Ralph was in his worst case, and he lambasted into Ralph Ferrara over some meaningless thing. I mean, but it was terrible. And I kept telling Dick Rowe, I said, "We're paying the piper for that." Because, you know, Ralph had retired. He was on his merry way, et cetera, et cetera. And if I had been Ralph Ferrara, I would have been incensed by the way Hocker treated him.
Wow.
But in any event, shortly after Williams was there, he appointed Milk. And I remember one of the items that they wanted was a memo about the review process, you know, disclosure operations in general. And I did most of the drafting and Rowe polished it up and we sent it up. And somehow Dick Rowe got a copy of the original back. And written in the margin was a note by Ben Milk that said bullshit and dated, etc. And I'm pretty sure, even though I was waiting for my 16, I'm pretty sure that Milk was sitting on it up there. But luckily, in the meantime, Vincent left, Ed Green came in, and Ed Green, strangely enough, I think he and I got along reasonably well. And it was one evening, and I just got furious about something, and I wrote him a memorandum. I wrote a memo to Ed Green about the fact that I'd been in that job for 3 years and didn't have my super grade. And so forth. And he immediately zoomed a memo up to Ben Milk, and he jumped on Ben Milk.
Oh.
And then about that same time, the SES things came in. Because I'm sure also with you, we were charter members of the SES. But money-wise, I waited 3 years to get the money on the job. Also in that time, if you I don't know if you were there at the time, but the infamous move to First Street.
Yeah, no, I went over to First Street.
Milk,
were you in First Street?
Yeah, I was over there.
Oh, you did?
Were you there for about a year?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, Milk.
Okay,
came
yeah,
down.
That was where I did those pension.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
44 releases.
He came down.
That's
and
right.
Said
then you became the chief counsel and came back.
Yeah.
He said that they needed more room and they were trying to decide, you know, who was going to have to move to First Street. And we did, you know, time and motion studies and evaluations, all that crap about how inappropriate it would be to split our division up over there. Because we had to come to the commission and interact with chief counsel's office. And, you know, and they started out initially having some stupid shuttle bus between First Street and 500 North Cap. And but anyway, the bottom line was that it was going to be cork thin. And I remember to this day, there was a staff meeting in a big room, and Harold Williams was there, and the whole division was there, okay? And Harold made the big announcement that half our division was going to go to First Street. Well, Charlie Ogilvy was so incensed, and he said something to Harold Williams, and I remember Dick Rowe and I were cringing, because Ogilvy said something like, well, this is one of the stupidest decisions I've ever heard, you know, moving half of operations over there, et cetera. Well, Harold excused himself and left the balance of the meeting up to Dick Canyon.
Oh,
remember?
Yeah.
Well, of course, the staff just chewed poor Dick Canyon up one side and down. You know, it didn't make any difference. They had made the decision. And so we had to work up a movement to First Street, and then Harold had his stupid idea of having the copies of the paintings, remember? He hung the paintings all around like that was going to help morale. Well, anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. But,
Well, Bill, let's return just for a moment to the late 60s, early 70s, when you were, I guess, a branch chief at that time. Is that correct? You became an AD in 74.
I became an AD in 74.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, when I got there in 69, Bill and I, there was a hot issue period going on. Mm-hmm. And I gather there was some sort of transition in the way filings were being handled, registration statements in particular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the commission was no longer looking at these things all the time. What was your experience as a branch chief in terms of this transition to the new method of looking at filings and not reviewing every one of them in detail and so forth? Sort of the selective review, I guess that was sort of the beginning of it back then.
When I became a branch chief in 65, yeah, the backlog was mounting, the time in registration was mounting, the staff wasn't happy about it. Registrants weren't happy about it. We weren't able to spend much, if any, time on the K reports. We did work on the proxies, but the numbers were just against us. And so we did. I don't really remember. I tried making some old notes here. I don't really remember which came first, the industry centralization or the selective review.
There was a selective review first. Yeah.
That. We decided that there had to be a way, the infamous phrase now, of doing more with less. I remember Levinson used to use that all the time. And in my branch, the branch chiefs in those days were kind of, you know, on their own, if you will, to get the job done. And I began to implement some things in my branch kind of along those lines, et cetera, et cetera. And that's one of the reasons when the Disclosure Ops Associate job opened up and I applied for it and I highlighted my systems that I was utilizing. And I remember when I got the job, I think Dick Rowe was the head of the division at that time. I think he's the one that picked me. But he said that we were going to have to do more and make it across the board for all the branches, some of the systems that I had there.
Uh-huh.
But I must say, if you had the scandals that we're reading about today, say Enron and so forth, where you have an accounting fraud where allegedly the independent public accountant is part of it, some of my systems probably wouldn't have worked, because one thing that we did look at was whether the registrant was a repeat registrant, had a clean opinion, mm-hmm. to the balance sheet. Well, if you have an accountant that's a crook, and he's going to hide things, etc., and then write a clean opinion, you really have a problem. If you're not reviewing everything, you would probably miss something like that.
That was a different era. I mean, when you could rely on the accountant.
Yeah. Was it right? Weren't some of the criteria clean opinion also a well-known broker dealer, a national accounting firm? And so we really, in those days, were relying heavily on what we assumed to be.
Well, and when it happened, that's what was being relied on. You know,
sure.
It's those same kinds of things were the basis of whether how closely you looked at somebody.
Well, we determined that first-time filers would be reviewed, and we had hoped that their first 10K would be reviewed also after becoming effective in marketing out. And the so-called repeat registrants, I don't really recall if we had we probably did have some kind of a size factor in there. If total assets were over X amount of money and it was repeat and they had good counsel, whatever that meant, and they had good accountants, whatever that meant, we probably gave it a no review, et cetera. And, we even did it, certainly on their K reports. Mm-hmm. So that was probably the beginning. I don't take the credit for all of it, but that probably was about the time where there was really public recognition in division that we couldn't do it all. There was just no way in hell we could do it. So little by little by little, we augmented the selective review system, which is, as we all gained experience, it got a little keener and better laid out and so forth.
So did you sort of initiate this on your own in your branch? Just decided that we're not going to review everything, and these are the criteria we're going to use for deciding?
I can remember, I don't know if I was a branch chief at the time or a senior analyst, but it was just overtime work, so I guess I wasn't a branch chief, and I was trying to get some of the 10K backlog down. I remember there had this big pile of 10Ks, and I was looking at the name of the company and leafing through and looking at the accountant's opinion, and if it was a clean opinion, I cleared it.
there was even a period of when we were under Levinson, there was a period when there was Saturday. There was overtime Saturday. I think we got paid, but you had to go in on Saturdays to clear up the backlog.
That was
the
Levinson thing.
And in my branch, John Burness, who was the branch chief, the guy who's that's terrible. The guy who's now in the international office, I can't even remember. That's terrible. He was my branch chief for a long time. He came, left the commission, going to private.
The commission went over to.
Kirkpatrick. Big blonde hair. Bob Strahota was my branch chief.
Yeah.
And he was doing all the 10Ks. Our branch didn't have to do it because I think he was probably using the same kind of system. He was an accountant as well as an attorney and a financial. I mean, he had it all.
Yeah.
And he'd been cranking out 10. In fact, on the day he left, he was in his office till 6 o'clock cranking out 10Ks. I mean, we were a group. We didn't have a backlog, so we didn't have to do that.
We had a something called Clear for the Record. Do you remember that? And it was like a sort of thing. And it didn't mean all that was that you wrote Clear for the Record. I think we may have looked at a couple of things, like Bill said, you know, like was it a clean opinion and was it a national firm? But basically, we just.
But that was in the early. That was early in the early 70s.
That was a Levinson thing.
Yeah, with Levinson.
And I'm not sure when Levinson came.
Well, it was between 69 and 72 because that was when I was in a branch and that's when I was doing it.
Yeah.
Or not doing it.
Well, Bill, what about your period as an assistant director in the mid 70s? You weren't there for very long. You got elevated to associate director. Was there anything memorable that you recall about that particular period?
I was an AD for 2 years. I became AD in 74 and associate in 76.
I guess that straddled the period between Alan Levinson and Dick Rowe as division director.
Right, yeah. Right. That's right. Well, again, work-wise, I think in those days it was one AD and two branches, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, my two branches, you know, I just augmented the system that I had as the branch chief into the two branches. And I can't specifically recall whether in those days the ADs had under them the senior accountant, the senior analyst, and the senior attorney. I'm drawing a dead blank
so.
On that.
I think so, because when I was in a branch, we had there was this. But under the ADs, each branch chief had a senior attorney, another undesignated or no, that's right. I don't think that came until later. I don't think the AD.
Funny, I'm drawing a dead blank on it, because I do remember why we implemented that, because there was becoming a morale factor about the upward mobility.
I think that was a little later.
Yeah.
We had big meetings with the Office of Personnel and with Civil Service about the job sheets and this and that. We had the classifiers up there, what these jobs were. And, well, if you have a 14 senior attorney under an AD, then, what about the grade levels in your branches and who's doing it? I mean, it was a nightmare, but we finally got it. It really opened my eyes that it's all politics, you know. If you have the blessings, if you will, of the chairman and the executive director and certain elements over on the Hill, mainly the ones who oversee your budget, and I'm speaking now of the Proxmires, the Dingle. I have a letter on my wall down there from Proxmire. Luckily, he felt that he and I had something in common. You know, I don't know what it was, except we entered the Federal Service about the same time. I don't think he was a Marine or what. But at that little moment in time, we had a window of opportunity, and the congressional oversight entities were happy with us, etc. And so we got those grades. And it made, even that was stopgap, because if you hire an attorney from, the better law schools, if you will, and they stay for 3 years and learn the securities field up to that point, we can't compete salary-wise. They're just going to launch right on out, just roll right out the door, and that's what we were up against. And even then, we could only offer them 14s. There. I really don't know what year we implemented that, but it was certainly after I became an associate in 1976. As an AD, I don't think we had any whirlwind matters that I'm aware of. I remember Levinson left and Rowe became head of the division. I do remember at some point in time under Levinson, we had a budget problem, because I remember there didn't appear to be money for the maintenance people to clean the damn building. Remember, the floors were dirty, the bathrooms were off. I remember one time we had a meeting of branch chiefs in Levinson's office, and the staff was getting upset. And it was mentioned in the meeting, Levinson was there, that the staff was upset, the place was dirty, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that they had overspent the budget, I guess, and they were looking for ways to get money. And they eliminated some of the nightly maintenance, emptied trash cans and so forth. Remember?
Well, it was worse than that. I vividly remember walking down one of the halls on our Corp Flynn floor, and I saw this big spot in the middle. I said, "What is that?" Turned out that the vinyl tile had worn through to the concrete underneath.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's how bad it was in that building.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no maintenance whatsoever.
Yeah. So we were, we were having some problems then under the budgets. But that's also about the time, as I recall, that the commissioner's offices, staff-wise, began to enlarge. And, you know, you had to pay salaries, so money had to come from someplace. And for God knows why, they had to take it out of the maintenance.
Well, Bill, what about your period as associate director? Now, you were associate director for, what, about a dozen years or so?
From 76 to 87. Yeah,
and
11 years.
You were in charge of the disclosure operations segment of the division's
division. I replaced Ralph Hocker when Ralph retired. It was disclosure operations. Yeah, that's right.
Actually, when Bill and I became associate director at the same time, at that time, remember for a while, we split the division three ways, and each one of us had a couple of assistant directors. And then gradually, I can't remember under who, I think probably after Dick left, gradually we began to be specialized and had either operations under, so I began to have legal making, you began to have all the operations, and I don't remember. In the beginning, they just divided, they just gave each one of us a third,
We
each one had certain assistant directors and branch chief under. Not necessarily for a couple of years, and then they started moving more to functions.
And I really don't remember why, but there were some reasons that we had several reorganizations. We moved offices around, literally moved offices around. We moved around the who was in charge of what.
Well, that was that whole period when industry specialization came in. Ernestine's office, they set up the office to the oversight office that Ernestine headed. It was over on First Street. The move to First Street, the industry specialization, all that happened just about the same time.
Well, there were also quite a few chairmen of the commission during that period that each had his own agenda. I mean,
I
think in the first 10 years I was there from 69 to 79, there was Hamer Budge, there was Ray Garrett. There was Rod Hills, there was Harold Williams, and then John Shadd.
Basically, I think Bill was right. Most of the changes came under Williams. I think I think the first ones you mentioned, Judge Budge.
Remember Judge Budge?
Yeah. Pretty much didn't make any major changes,
at least in
Division Corporation Finance. They may have done it in other divisions. I think the big changes in the Division of Corporation Finance came under Harold Williams. Is that what you would call it? I think that's when, you remember, Harold Williams was on the Al Summers special studies.
Oh.
Remember the one that I was on?
Yeah.
And he was on our committee, and he became chairman, actually before the committee was completed, his work, but towards the end. That's how he came in.
Oh.
Well, in line, because I have them listed down here. After Hamer Budge, you had Bill Casey, and then
Casey, of course, yes, I've heard about Casey,
and Cook, and then Ray Garrett, okay. And then the last four in my time were Hills, Williams, Shadd, and Reuter, okay. Well, under Rod Hills, there were personnel problems and morale problems, et cetera, but it more involved work, you know, between the professional staff and some disagreements. There were things going on up in the chairman's office that shall remain nameless, et cetera, some strange things, et cetera. But it really reached a climax under Williams. And then, thank God, after that, then under Shadd, things mellowed out and got back to being more work-wise, professional, let's get the real job done for what the hell we're here and all this other stuff. Reuter, I was only under him just a few months. He seemed like a very nice guy in my mind. I don't know. But under Williams, it was bad. When one of the last reorganizations that we had was when we went to First Street, and we realigned the functions, et cetera, et cetera, and we implemented under Ernestine the Office of Operating Procedures and Training.
Who was the director?
Was that Ralph? And Ernestine was over there with me at First Street, and we have these evening meetings. Remember, you came over one time with John Mooney. and we were, I forgot what the subject was, but we were airing this out. And that's kind of when we had the brainchild of industry centralization. And I'll tell you, that idea really originated with Ernestine. Ernestine had the idea, and then we talked about it. But I'll tell you, at about that time, Roe left, and Ed Green was there as the director. And I don't know why, but he and I seemed to get along okay. All right. And then shortly thereafter, Lee Spencer came in as the deputy. Okay. Well, you know, Ernestine and I talked, and we decided we were going to propose industry centralization, you know, moving the alphabet and the industries from this and that, and who shot John. I don't recall that we really went into the ADs and got input. But I'm sure we had a meeting, because I would never just jam it down the throats. But I don't think we had much in the way of really, well, what do you guys think, and what's your vote, and what do you think? I think we just drafted it up, and I remember a lot of things were going on in those days, a lot of which weren't happy at times. But you remember Roberta Carmel had a legal assistant by the name of Jack Wheeler. And, but just before that, and I'll elaborate in a moment, but Linda Quinn became available, and she was going to hire on as a consultant. Well, Ernestine knew Linda and really liked her. Well, I didn't know Linda Quinn, and I don't think Ed Green did either. And it may have originated up in Williams' office. I really don't know, but they wanted to bring Linda on as a consultant.
She's attorney fellow, yeah.
There was some debate on where to put her. And I remember that that Ernestine stopped in my office, and she thought it was a great idea. So she came in, you know, and I liked Ernestine. I thought she was okay. She was a little hard on some of the folks in her branches if she didn't like them, et cetera. But she was smart, and et cetera. And I remember telling Ernestine, listen, if you think it'll work out, fine. And we'll hire her as, I thought it was a consultant, but anyway.
Yeah, she was an attorney.
And I said, and we'll put her in your office, the Office of Operating Procedures, and that's where we did. And Ed Green rang up and asked me if that was okay with me, and I said, sure. So we brought her on, and she did a lot of work. She was helpful.
When she was over there, yeah.
Then about a month later, my phone rings and said Green, and he brings up Jack Wheeler. Well, I didn't know Jack Wheeler from Adam, and my only experience with Roberta was when she'd have those horrible meetings at the commission table over an enforcement matter, and she would sit on the left flank of the table, and Stan Sportman always sat on the right flank at the staff level. I remember there was a little poster about like that. Roberta was there, and Stan was here, and I don't care what the subject matter was, something, you know, simple, innocuous, and Harold would sit there, and I just know to this day that Harold put her up to this. And every time Stanley appeared, she would be all over him.
I don't think they're better needed anyway.
And eventually, it would become a shouting match. And you know, we'd just sit there, and they'd be going at it, et cetera. So anyway, but when Ed Green called me up and said that Roberta's legal assistant was being reassigned into one of the divisions, and our division was one, and Ed Green rang up and said, I don't know where to put him, et cetera. And we were thinking, you don't have a legal assistant, and that would be good if we put him with you. Well, at first I balked because I didn't know who the hell he was. It had really 50-50 results, but I agreed to bring him down. And then what they tried, they brought him down as a 14, and they were trying to get him a 15. And so it got involved in these desk audits, and the classifiers came down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and it went on and on and on and on. And they turned it down. But somehow, surprise, surprise, between the chairman's office and Ed Green, he got his 15. I remember my secretary hated him with a passion. And you remember the time I went to Charlottesville to that school down there? I was gone about maybe three weeks. Well, when I came, my phone was, I'd be in the classroom, and I'd get these goddamn phone calls, and it'd be either my secretary, who's hell on wheels on a good day, Gerald Blunt. Black. Yeah. Or Jack Wheeler, and he'd be trying to go through my inbox, and she wouldn't let him. And it was horrible. But in the meantime, he was writing the book about the Vietnam War with all those guys. And one day I was out of town. He asked if he could use my office because they were taping it and all that. They wrote the book. I have a copy of it. Down the guy that became Secretary of the Navy.
Jack was very heavily involved in the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
Yeah, very heavily involved.
Oh, yeah? Well, then the problem with the... with the newspaper reporter who taped him illegally.
Lots of stuff happened. Yeah.
My wife says I ought to write a book. That's what Linda Quinn told me one time. I ought to write a book about all this silly stuff. But anyway. With Ernestine's office, that's when we really moved ahead on industry centralization. Oh, I know what I started to say about Roberta. When I had Jack Wheeler, he thought it would be a wonderful idea if we invited Roberta over and introduced her to the staff of Disclosure Operations and had a nice meeting at First Street. So I told him, okay. And he brought her over, and Ed Green was there. And so I'm making this little presentation about Disclosure Ops, and I said, and one thing that we're seriously considering is industry centralization and then augmenting in writing the selective review system and in writing these manuals about this or that. Well, I made a mistake. I didn't tell Ed Green about it beforehand. And Ed Green is sitting in the back. Well, and he was the division director, so I mean, I aired. And, Roberta Carmel, she thought this was just so wonderful. The branch chiefs were meeting her, shaking her hand, and she went back and sent me this wonderful memo about how wonderful it was and so forth. I guess I made a friend, and it was Jack Wheeler's idea. But anyway, about 10 minutes after the meeting, Lee Spencer appears at my door, and he wants to take me to lunch. I said, okay, we go to lunch, and then he proceeds to unload on me how it wasn't very nice to be talking about all these wonderful things, and he and Ed Green didn't know anything about it. So, I couldn't even say, oh, I thought I sent you a memo. It must have got lost. It must have got lost on the shuttle bus between First Street and there. Well, I'll tell you another little story about being...
But it all worked out, though.
It all worked out, yeah. Well, Ed Green, you know... But he saw the drafts, and he did some editing and stuff. He loved it. He thought it was just wonderful. Industry centralization. I don't think all the ADs liked it all that much with their assigned thing.
They were worried about,
and branch chiefs didn't like it because they were worried about promotions because they were afraid if they got typecast as being the... In this industry, that if another job came up in another industry or an AD post that came up that had other industries, that they would automatically be out of the picture because they didn't know about those industries.
Well, I got calls from that, not really, but I think some of those real estate folks with those limited partnerships and so forth. That's something else that I got stuck with. I had to go out and make the annual presentation for Dick Rowe to these real estate thing with real estate. Thingamajigs, Don Augustine, I guess.
It's too late now.
Well, they called me up and they didn't. They weren't happy. They were under Borkoff. They thought Herb was tough on them, etc. But
and over the years, he was.
By the time he left, he really knew that industry.
Too.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, in all candor,
how is he though?
I really don't know if I even had my reservations about this selective review system because I thought we ought to do 100% of everything, you know, to protect investors, etc. I'm not getting now into the integrated disclosure system. I think, you know, I was a champion of that. That was a wonderful idea. It made a lot of sense. But we had to do this, the industry centralization and the selective review system, in my opinion, because it was kind of the name of the game. With the folks on the Hill, with the GAO, because also we underwent that horrible audit. Remember the audit? Mm-hmm. That was also underwent.
That was
I, I don't really mean this, but I used to wonder if he wrote that or not.